The headlines: Iran's foreign minister is on an official visit to China. He says strategic issues are on the agenda of talks with his with the Chinese officials. Russia says it will not wait forever for the U.S. and NATO to respond to its security demands over the Ukraine crisis. And also in our headlines, fresh revelations emerge about parties held at the British Prime Minister's office during last year's COVID lockdown amid calls for Boris Johnson's resignation. Hello and welcome, everybody. Iran's foreign minister, who is on an official visit to China, says strategic issues are on the agenda of his talks with the officials there. Hossein Amir Abdullahian explained that the talks cover a range of issues, including international developments as well as political and economic issues. He made the remarks upon his arrival in the Chinese city of Wuxi earlier in the day. He said Iran and China have had good cooperation in recent months. He also noted that the two sides have made good progress in different areas in line with their national interests. Amir Abdullahian has already met with his Chinese counterpart, Wang Yi. We're now joined by senior fellow at the Pangolin Institution, Kindo Zhu, who's joining us from Beijing. Sir, welcome to the program. Give us your thoughts on the significance of this trip to China by Iran's foreign minister.
This is the first cabinet minister from the new government of Iran, you know, visiting China. So the visit itself is the first. That's significant. We know last year, Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi visited Iran, and both countries struck a deal of a 25-year agreement. So that's significant because that's a long-term cooperation in a multiple area between the two countries. So I think the two foreign ministers will compare their notes to see where we are now and how we can better implement those agreements, mostly in the economic and diplomatic fields. If you look at it diplomatically, the two countries are working closely. I think that the visit of the foreign minister itself is a strong support, a sign of support from Iran to China, to Chinese, Beijing Winter Olympics. We know that some foreign countries, Western countries led by the United States, a couple of them basically, issued, made some noise of boycotting the Beijing Winter Olympics. I think the presence of Iranian foreign minister here is a sign of support that, we are with you. And obviously, we strongly oppose to that kind of, tricks played by Washington against China. So this is obviously a welcome sign for the Chinese side. So this is only a part of the comprehensive cooperation between the two sides.
And very briefly, before we leave you, Mr. Zhu, what are some of the pressing issues of mutual interest between Tehran and Beijing at the moment?
I think the two countries will continue to cooperate in the fight against the pandemic, because both countries, just like the rest of the world, we are still in the middle of the pandemic, in particular with Omicron, it is more contagious. So that requires some extra efforts to deal with that, either vaccine or, drugs. And secondly, it's really about diplomatic cooperation. For example, both countries will support each other in their fight against this long-arm jurisdiction, in particular sanctions upon Iran, sanctions upon China, by the United States, and also some other Western countries, including European Union. So that's something, unfair practice by the Western countries. And thirdly, I would say probably the two countries will also, I think they have been working together in terms of this nuclear program, the negotiation in Vienna between Iran and China, Russia, and Washington, and European countries over there. So China has been supporting Iran's position that we always should keep in mind is the United States who withdrew from the deal, and the United States should take the first step to come back to the deal. And also, China will support the Iranian request. The U.S. Should make a promise, like a written guarantee. They will not withdraw again from any new agreement over there.
All right. Thanks a lot, Senior Fellow at Pangolin Institution, Kindo Zhu, joining us from Beijing. Moving on, Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi says his administration is putting efforts to remove anti-Iran sanctions high on the agenda. In a tweet, President Raisi said the efforts to neutralize the sanctions are not tied to the ongoing talks in Vienna to revive the 2015 Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, known as the JCPOA. He said despite the existing sanctions, Iran is selling oil. Raisi said the sales have now increased to the level that no worries are left and revenues are being returned to the country. In separate remarks on Friday, President Raisi said sanctions and threats cannot hinder Iran's progress. He cited the country's military development, saying they've been achieved despite severe restrictions on this sector. Russia's foreign minister says that he is cautiously optimistic over the progress made at negotiations in Vienna to revive the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA. Sergei Lavrov says there are real desire between Iran and the United States to understand specific concerns and consider such concerns in the general package of documents. Lavrov says his country thinks the two sides will come to an agreement. The United States is not directly involved in the Vienna talks as it withdrew from the JCPOA back in 2018. Moving on, tensions heating up between Russia and the West. Moscow says sanctions against President Vladimir Putin would mean a complete breakdown of ties. The Kremlin spokesman has described as unsuccessful Wednesday's talks with NATO in Brussels. Separately, Russian Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Ryabkov says the talks led to no progress, and thus there is no need for further discussions in the coming days. The senior diplomat says the U.S. and its allies rejected Russia's key demands, including guarantees that NATO will not further expand eastwards. He's accused the Western side of lacking flexibility and refused to rule out the possibility of Russian military deployment to Venezuela and Cuba in case of heightened tensions with the U.S. over Ukraine. In recent months, Moscow's ties with the West have taken a turn for the worse, both sides warning about a new armed conflict in Europe. Political commentator Mike Billington believes that Russia has both the strength and the right to protect itself against NATO.
The Russians were on the verge of catching up and have now at this point caught up and perhaps gone beyond the U.S. Western military capacity. They have the strength to challenge this attempt to move NATO forces up to their border. The Russians, of course, do remember when Napoleon and later Hitler brought forces up to their border and what the consequences were, and they will not allow it, and they absolutely should not. On the other hand, the danger is not gone by a long shot. We have madmen, and I mean madmen, in the U.S. military industrial complex who need a war. And even though they know they could not win such a war against either Russia or China, you then create the conditions in which the madmen like Admiral Richard, the head of the U.S. Strategic Command, who believes a nuclear war is likely, and others, including Senator Weicker in the U.S. Senate, who has literally called for a first-strike nuclear bombardment of Russia.
The Taliban are calling on the United States to release Afghanistan's frozen assets to avert a deepening humanitarian crisis there. The group's spokesman, Zabihullah Mujahid, urged Washington to respond positively to the international voice. This comes a day after the UN chief called on the international community to unfreeze the country's foreign reserves and jumpstart its banking system. Antonio Guterres urged the U.S. to take the lead on the issue to prevent, quote, the nightmare unfolding in Afghanistan. Washington has been refusing to release nearly $9.5 billion in Afghan assets, which it froze after the Taliban was swept to power last August. It's estimated that more than half of Afghanistan's population of the 38 million is facing acute hunger this winter. Another blow to Boris Johnson's shaky premiership. Fresh reports say staff at the British Prime Minister's office partied on the eve of the socially distanced funeral of the Queen's husband, Prince Philip. The UK-based Daily Telegraph says number 10 staff gathered on April the 16th last year for two separate leaving events. One was for James Slack, the Prime Minister's departing Director of Communications. Another was for a personal photographer of Johnson. The events took place the day before Prince Philip was laid to rest At that time, social gatherings were banned across the UK as part of COVID restrictions. Johnson himself was absent at those parties, but he's already facing calls to resign over several more parties held at Downing Street during lockdowns. Critics, including those from Labour, say Johnson is unfit to head the government and cannot be trusted. And the British Queen's second son, Prince Andrew, is stripped of his royal and military titles as he faces a U.S. civil case for sexual assault. According to British media, Prince Andrew will no longer be entitled to enjoy his Royal Highness title. The Buckingham Palace has also said the prince has given up his honorary military titles and charitable roles. That comes after more than 150 British veterans wrote to Queen Elizabeth, calling on her to strip Andrew of his ranks and titles in the armed forces. The Duke of York is facing public outrage over his sexual misconduct. He denies any wrongdoing, but on Wednesday, a U.S. federal court judge rejected an appeal over allegations that Andrew sexually assaulted a woman when she was 17. The woman accuses Andrew of assaulting her back in 2001. 5 months into an energy crisis in the UK, a controversial blog post by one of the country's major energy suppliers has prompted a wave of outrage. It comes as average households face a sharp rise in their energy bills starting in spring, coupled with rising taxes and stalling wages. Our London correspondent, Saeed Fureza, has more.
If you want to keep warm this winter and can't afford to keep your heating on, wear an extra layer, do star jumps, or hug your pet for warmth, if you have one, that is. 3 of 10 recommendations from Britain's third largest energy supplier to British households. Some of the Britons we talked to had this to say in response.
Disgusting. Probably just like what most people think, to be fair. And if you're anybody like me who's suffering in a house with mould, damp and excessive cold anyway with uninsulated houses, then it's even 10 times worse. So
it's absolutely horrendous. Because, I mean, I saw something on the news the other day where one energy company was saying, get yourself a pet to keep you warm. Did you see that? And all this sort of nonsense. I mean, how are people going to manage?
The company's founder has since apologized, but he also said this.
Globally, energy prices are going up, and we need a system that consumers pay the true cost of energy. There is no way to magically make that lower.
There may not be a magical way of pushing energy prices down, but there must be something the government can do to contain the situation, like a working energy strategy.
And the simplest way of doing it would actually be measure it according to income. So those who've got more wealth and the broadest shoulders should pay most, and those who can't afford to pay least and get protected by the rest of society. But at the moment, no one's doing anything.
With barely any rise in their income and faced with rising taxes, millions of British households are shaking at the prospect of a nearly 50% increase in their energy bills in spring.
Since October last year, the energy price cap set by industry regulator Ofgem has been at more than $1,700. That is expected to change in April by nearly $1,000 when Ofgem sets the new cap, resulting in British homeowners' energy bills rising significantly.
You're going to see pressure on the weakest this year, and that's what's so unfair. There'll be more discontent. Does it mean there'll be riots and things like that? No, but there'll probably be demonstrations of people concerned about the level of poverty.
While the British government drags its feet on dealing with the looming cost of living catastrophe caused by stalling wages and rising tax and energy bills, less fortunate Britons will have a tough winter to battle through, with or without a pet for warmth. Saeed Fureza, London.
After a short respite due to the coronavirus, a new report shows that the situation of asylum seekers on the western edge of Europe has become worse than ever. It comes on the heels of a manslaughter lawsuit against the coast guards of the United Kingdom and France following the deadly mass drowning on record in the English Channel late last year. Rami Mazari has more in this story.
Year-end data shows that 2021 saw a massive, deadly, and record worsening of the situation for asylum seekers trying to enter the United Kingdom from France. The size of the Calais refugee camp tripled to 30,000 people, even though camp demolitions occur almost daily and treatment is routinely denounced as inhumane. Nearly 30,000 refugees reached the United Kingdom last year, but at the cost of 1,000 people who became shipwrecked, resulting in at least 44 deaths. November saw almost 30 refugees drown in a single night, the deadliest such incident ever recorded in the English Channel. 3 years ago, Paris and London decided that France would close all routes to the UK, leaving dangerous sea crossings the only option.
What's become known as Fortress Europe has gotten better and better at organizing themselves to become even more harsh and even more deadly. The aim is to show the world's refugees, look at how badly you will be received. Don't come here anymore.
Late last month, a French NGO filed a manslaughter lawsuit against the coast guards of both France and the United Kingdom for allegedly ignoring the drowning boat's distress calls to the rescue services of both nations.
We're on a path which is incredible in how it is both lamentable and repeatable. Unless we do something immediately, such atrocities will continue. The European Union has allowed the Mediterranean Sea to become the biggest graveyard in the world. Must we make the English Channel a rival?
The vast majority of refugees in the world are caused by Western military interventions, often led by France and the UK, in places like Syria, Mali, Afghanistan, Libya, Iraq, and elsewhere. Politicians in both the UK and France, where a presidential election campaign is effectively underway, have been repeatedly accused of scapegoating immigrants in order to win over their domestic electorates, which lean heavily to the political right. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
That's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
It is now for the UN to earnestly strive for ending the crisis by condemning the Saudi aggression and supporting the people of Yemen, instead of merely saying that 24 million Yemenis are in dire need of humanitarian aid, including 10 million suffering from extreme levels of hunger, says Kayhan International staff writer in an article published under the heading "No Military Solution to Saudi War Upon Yemen." Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. There is no military solution to the war imposed upon Yemen by Saudi Arabia and the UAE, which is now in its seventh year with terrible destruction of the infrastructure, huge loss of life, displacement of millions from their homes, and famine staring in the face. These are the sufferings of the aggressed nation, the Arab world's most impoverished, whose death toll, either through war or related issues, stands at almost 400,000 men, women, and children. But this ghastly catastrophe inflicted by the aggressors has failed to break the iron resolve of Yemen's steadfast defenders. Of course, the invaders, especially miserably rich Saudi Arabia, have also suffered extensive damage, not because of the hundreds of billions of petrodollars squandered in a vain bid to subjugate Yemen, but because of the relentless retaliation with drones and missiles by Yemen's legitimate government in Sana'a, led by the popular Ansarullah movement, on strategic industrial and military sites of the aggressors. The regime in Riyadh, though it has air superiority to bomb, destroy, and kill the Yemeni people, it has realized that all the terrible weapons supplied by the US, Britain, and France at exorbitant prices can never ensure it any victory. It is now looking for a face-saving exit and is holding in direct negotiations with the Yemenis, although its arrogance makes it hard to admit the truth. The Yemeni defenders, for their part, are confident of holding their ground and, if possible, carry the battle to the enemy camp, but would certainly prefer a diplomatic resolution to the conflict, however, neither with Riyadh or Abu Dhabi. They maintain that only intra-Yemeni talks between the various tribal groups, political parties, and religious sectors can provide a lasting solution to the crisis in Yemen. Mohammed Abdul Salam, the chief negotiator of Yemen's National Salvation Government, during his meeting in the Omani capital of Muscat, recently with Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian, discussed these issues. He thanked the Islamic Republic for its moral support to the besieged people of Yemen, while briefing Iran's top diplomat of the situation in his war-torn country. Amir Abdullahian expressed deep regret over continuation of the war imposed on the Yemeni people by Saudi Arabia, and stressed the need for an end to the country's siege and war. He agreed that the problems in Yemen should be settled through intra-Yemeni talks in order to guarantee the unity, independence, and territorial integrity of Yemen without any meddling by outside parties. In view of these undeniable facts, it is now for the UN to earnestly strive for ending the crisis by condemning the Saudi aggression and supporting the people of Yemen, instead of merely saying that 24 million Yemenis are in dire need of humanitarian aid, including 10 million suffering from extreme levels of hunger.
Is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran. Or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Say to America is be true to what you said on paper.
We won't back down.
Stop the witches!
We're here now.
We will resist.
I can't breathe. Help me. Please.
We the people.
Self-proclaimed beacon of democracy faced unprecedented assaults on its capital in opposition to election results and claims of voter fraud. January 6, 2021 revealed once again how U.S. democracy is fragile and more rhetoric than substance. It also exemplified the incompetence of U.S. officials in protecting their own capital, with scenes of congressmen and women hiding under chairs and tables, fearing for their lives. Many believe that the attack was an attempted coup pushed by outgoing President Donald Trump, and others believe it was an effort to save so-called democracy against a fraudulent election with illegitimate results.
or coup.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to We the People. I'm your host, Daniel Arya, and in this episode, we'll discuss the Capitol riot on the anniversary of the January 6, 2021 events in Washington, D.C., reasons behind the attack on Congress, claims of voter fraud, Donald Trump's role in the riots, the divide in the country, and what is to come in the 2024 elections. In the program, we're pleased to have our two guests on our show, John Pfeffer, writer, editor, activist, and co-director of Foreign Policy in Focus at the Institute of Policy Studies, and Malik Abdul, political commentator and GOP strategist. Both of our guests are stationed out of Washington, D.C. Please stay tuned.
On January 6, 2021, while the U.S. Joint Session of Congress was assembled to count the electoral votes, Donald Trump held another assembly, calling the elections a fraud and cheering his supporters to take back the country. Trump told the protesters before the riot, "If you don't fight like hell, you're not going to have a country anymore."
Now it is up to Congress to confront this egregious assault on our democracy. And after this, we're going to walk down, and I'll be there with you. We're going to walk down anyone you want, but I think right here we're going to walk down to the Capitol. And we're going to cheer on our brave senators and congressmen and women. And we're probably not going to be cheering so much for some of them. Because you'll never take back our country with weakness. You have to show strength and you have to be strong.
After Trump's supporters stormed Congress, forcing representatives to hide under chairs and tables and ultimately evacuating it, the tables turned against Trump and many officials strongly condemned the attack and called for his second impeachment. This prompted Trump to give another address condemning the attack on the Capitol, separating himself from his supporters and ultimately his own wards.
I would like to begin by addressing the heinous attack on the United States Capitol. Like all Americans, I am outraged by the violence, lawlessness, and mayhem. I immediately deployed the National Guard and federal law enforcement to secure the building and expel the intruders. America is and must always be a nation of law and order. The demonstrators who infiltrated the Capitol have defiled the seat of American democracy. To those who engaged in the acts of violence and destruction, you do not represent our country. And to those who broke the law, you will pay.
On that day, the Capitol complex was locked down. Lawmakers and staff were evacuated, while rioters assaulted law enforcement officers, vandalized property, and occupied the building for several hours. Five people died either shortly before, during, or following the event. One was shot by Capitol Police, another died of a drug overdose, and three died of other causes. Many people were injured, including 138 police officers. So what were the main reasons for the riot?
The main reason for the Capitol riots was, of course, Donald Trump, who was president of the United States at that moment. And he had, of course, refused to acknowledge the results of the 2020 election. He continued to argue that he was, in fact, the winner, not Joe Biden. And he encouraged his followers to continue to question the election and to try to overturn the election. And the January 6th rally that he called in Washington was the latest effort on his part to force a confrontation with his own vice president, Mike Pence, who was constitutionally required to certify the election. And he encouraged his followers to put pressure on the vice president and also on Congress not to certify the elections, which was supposed to happen on January 6th.
Four police officers committed suicide in the aftermath of the attacks. In January, an MPD officer, a 12-year veteran of the force, and Capitol Police Officer Howard Libengood, a 16-year veteran, both of whom had responded to the 6 January attack, died by suicide. 2 other officers took their lives, and the announcement of the deaths of 26-year-old De Freitag and Hashida came a week after several officers testified to a House of Representatives Select Committee investigating the 6 January insurrection.
Well, I think the pressures on the defenders of the Capitol were immense. They did not expect there to be a violent confrontation. And I think the kind of vitriol and the criticism directed by Trump supporters at the defenders, the guards, and the other police officers who were defending the Capitol, the vitriol and the criticism was very, very heavy. And I think that there was a psychological toll that all of these defenders had to experience. And for some of them, it was too much.
Donald Trump and his campaign had filed several lawsuits in different states contesting election results, citing irregularities and voter fraud, which was turned down by the courts. After pressure from the White House, the Attorney General William Barr resigned, refusing to not accept the election results. A year on, a committee is reviewing the January 6th incident and calling former White House staff and other former officials to testify. So how relevant were the voter fraud claims?
Well, what we've heard is that there were actually people who were concerned about the election being stolen. What initially started actually as a series of marches, or if you will, here in D.C., which is where I live, I'm in Washington, D.C., I actually participated in the first march. That was, I think, probably sometime December or late November. So I participated in the first one, but this one, people were upset. And so they decided to go into the Capitol and have a really riot at the Capitol. But I don't think there was any justification for it. But what we didn't know is that those were some of the reasons that people were giving.
Everything I believe in and everything.
Donald Trump also went against the Supreme Court in his tweets, stating the U.S. Supreme Court has been totally incompetent and weak on the massive election fraud that took place in the 2020 presidential election. We have absolute proof, but they don't want to see it. No standing, they say. If we have corrupt elections, we have no country. What was Trump's role in the riot?
Donald Trump and his allies essentially created the conditions in which the rioters could come together, and they promoted a philosophy that animated the rioters. You could say that Donald Trump essentially lit the fuse that then exploded into the January 6th insurrection.
Some Republicans also criticized Trump's actions after the elections and likened him to a child. Republican Congressman Adam Kinzinger responded to Trump's tweets, calling them a temper tantrum and crazy conspiracies. Addressing Donald Trump, Kinzinger said he was trying to burn the place down on the way out because you can't handle losing. Twitter permanently suspended Trump's Twitter account, citing risk of further incitement of violence. Did these comments and prosecutions affect the belief of Trump supporters?
Oh, no. No, those hardcore supporters, they were going to believe that whether people were arrested or even those who have actually been prosecuted. I don't think that for a certain percentage of Americans, there's nothing that you would be able to say to convince them that the election itself was not stolen. I don't believe of the 74 or so million people who voted for Donald Trump, this is, which I am one of those, most of us don't believe that the election was stolen. But I do expect that you'll find people who will continue to believe that in the same way that people believed that Donald Trump coordinated with Russia to steal the election in 2016. People still believe that, even though our federal government has said that's not true.
A committee has been formed in the House of Representatives to investigate the January 6th attack on Congress. According to a new report released by the January 6th committee, former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows sent an email that day saying the National Guard will be present to protect pro-Trump people in the lead-up to the U.S. Capitol insurrection. So why was security so low at the Capitol that day?
Well, I don't think anybody really took the rioters' own slogans and propaganda seriously. It was expected that they were just a small group of malcontents. But to be honest, of course, if a different president had been in office at that time, that president probably would have provided greater security. And Donald Trump, of course, was the president at that time, and he did not provide sufficient security because, of course, he questioned the events of the election, and I think he ultimately wanted there to be a confrontation between his supporters and his own vice president and Congress.
The committee's chairman said the panel is looking at issuing subpoenas to Republican members of Congress to force their cooperation. This panel is trying to establish then-President Donald Trump's actions while thousands of his supporters attacked police, vandalized the Capitol, and sent members of Congress and then-Vice President Mike Pence running for their lives.
Vice President Pence and his family quickly moved down the stairs. The Vice President turns around briefly as he's headed down. As Pence was being evacuated, rioters started to spread throughout the Capitol. And you can hear the mob calling for the death of the Vice President of the United States.
The United States is more divided than ever. Perhaps it has not been so divided since the Civil War between the North and the South. After a term of four tremulous years, Donald Trump lost the elections to Joe Biden, but did not concede till the last minute. He went against his own Vice President Mike Pence and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. In rallies against the outcome of the elections, some Trump supporters were calling to hang Mike Pence. How serious is the divide in the country?
It's a real serious divide. It's something that's been building for a while. I would probably say since I first started following politics, you know, this kind of started in earnest. I would probably say, at least as far as the toxic divide, under the George W. Bush administration, it continued through Barack Obama's administration, Donald Trump's administration, and the same will exist now in the Biden administration. I think that people use these type of opportunities. People foment a lot of anger. They push a lot of really hate. And unfortunately, I think that social media has played a very large role in that because it allows people to really be their worst selves and be praised for it. And being it's financially profitable to be that way. And I think that's an unfortunate thing. But we are seriously divided here in the United States. And unlike what many people thought when Joe Biden got in office, that he would be able to change that, he hasn't, because this has been a long time in the making.
Now with Trump wanting to run again and Biden's approval rating falling, political spectators are skeptical about America's political future and wonder if there would ever be some kind of unity in the country. Experts are worried about violence and more riots, since nothing seems to sow the rift among the people and politicians.
Well, the 2024 elections are still quite a bit away, but unfortunately, there does seem to be increased polarization and even increased examples of threats coming from Congress, from members of Congress, as well as directed toward members of Congress. And because of that, it would seem that there is, unfortunately, a great likelihood that there would be violence both before and after the 2024 election.
A new University of Massachusetts Amherst poll highlights how partisanship has hardened in the year since the deadly January 6th riot and the stark breakdown on how Democrats and Republicans view that day and the results of last November's presidential race. So will Donald Trump run again in the 2024 elections?
Well, I'm hoping that Donald Trump actually doesn't run. I'm one of those who believe that if Donald Trump another Donald Trump term wouldn't actually be good, as much as I support him. But I think that a lot of people are realizing that Joe Biden actually overpromised and under-delivered on a lot of things. And I think that's the biggest thing that people are seeing now with Joe Biden. His mental acuity aside and the criticisms of that, and he's not being as sharp as even Donald Trump was, I think a lot of people are seeing that there were a lot of things that they thought would happen under a Joe Biden presidency that's just not going to happen in many ways, because that's just not how our federal government works. There are a lot of expectations that people have of Joe Biden and Kamala Harris as vice president, but none of that at this point is coming into fruition. And I think that's going to be the biggest thing that will harm Democrats, not just in 2022 during our midterm cycle, but also in 2024 during our next presidential election in 2024.
Also, according to a Morning Consult political poll, more voters say they would like to see former President Donald Trump run in 2024 than Biden, in a troubling sign for the sitting president as his approval ratings continue to sink.
It's still early in the Biden administration. He hasn't even been in office for 1 year, and it's quite common for presidents to suffer a decline in popularity after their honeymoon period. So I anticipate that his approval ratings will increase over the next year. The Democrats, of course, will suffer a setback of some kind in the midterm elections of 2022. But the question really is what the situation will be 4 years from now. That's hard to predict. But I expect that the Democrats will have concrete wins, legislative wins, that they can use to increase the likelihood that people will come back to the polls and support them again. And we have to remember that Donald Trump's negative approval ratings are still very high. In other words, his negative rating is very high. So that will likely make it very difficult for the former president to become a president again.
What is interesting is that more voters might want Trump in the race than Biden, but most don't want to see either candidate on the 2024 ballot. Roughly 2 in 5 voters, 39%, said Trump should run for president in 2024, compared with 34% who said the same of Biden. The majority of voters opposed 2024 campaigns from Trump, 56%, and Biden, 58%. What are the reasons behind these responses to the polls?
There's a lot that can happen between now and 2024, but I think that because there have been people here in the United States who have not been happy with the job that Joe Biden has done since he's been in the White House, I think people will have a different perspective, because they were led to believe that the only thing that you had to do was to get rid of Donald Trump and everything else would fall in place. And Joe Biden himself said that he wanted to he ran for president because he realized that the soul of the nation was actually harmed, and he wanted to bring the country back from the brinks of whatever it is that he said was wrong with the country.
Now, the United States has repeatedly supported color revolutions throughout the world, replacing elected governments with claims of vote fraud and by encouraging people who believe that their elections were stolen to pour out into the streets and hold demonstrations. Democrats and Republicans alike have supported some of these so-called revolutions and even participated in the demonstrations. It's interesting that when a similar event on a smaller scale takes place in their own backyard, they collectively act shocked and disgusted.
People of Ukraine, this is your moment. Народе український, це ваш момент.
This is about you, no one else.
Це про вас.
This is about the future you want for your country. This is about the future you deserve.
Це про ваше майбутнє, про майбутнє вашої країни. Це про майбутнє, на яке ви заслуговуєте.
A future in Europe.
Майбутнє Європи.
A future of peace.
Майбутнє
миру. With all of your neighbors.
Майбутнє всіх ваших сусідів.
The free world is with you. America is with you. I am with you. And the destiny you seek lies in Europe.
І ваша доля.
Ukraine will make Europe better, and Europe will make Ukraine better.
Thank you. Thank you.
Some of the similar actions by the public prompted and funded by the United States around the world in order to install puppet governments supporting U.S. agenda occurred after Trump lost the elections in 2020. Witnessing the response of U.S. officials from the suspension of Trump's Twitter account to criminally charging up to 600 people in the January 6th riots displays the U.S. hypocritical approach towards elections and democracy.
Yeah, I believe there are similarities to what we're seeing around the world when it comes to people protesting their government, protesting their democracy, if you will. I think the biggest distinction, well, probably difference is that this is typically something we don't see in the United States. A lot of things changed once Donald Trump got into office, and people like to really focus on what Republicans have done, but really the psyche of our whole country changed once Donald Trump was actually elected president, because prior to that, we never here in the U.S. Protested presidents or people winning the presidency. That changed in 2016 once Donald Trump was actually elected, where people began to protest in ways that we haven't seen.
And now once again, people and politicians are bracing themselves for another Donald Trump campaign and his possible win in the 2024 elections. Win or lose, many commentators believe that in the present poisonous political climate, riots, violence, and more divide are a given in the next presidential elections and its aftermath. Well, everyone, that was our show. I'm your host, Daniel Arya. Do join us again next week for another episode of We the People. Bye-bye for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastorday.com/en. And now, you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.